Today's Pieces of Eighth is a reading of a Big Finish Publish short trip featuring the Eighth Doctor and Lucy Miller. And after this, we've got a chat with author Eddie Robson. And before you ask, we've used the era correct version of the theme.
Doctor Who, Short Trips, Decorative Purposes, by Eddie Robson. Originally published in Big Finish Short Trips, The Ghosts of Christmas. I met the guy who made them, you know. I was there when it happened. Well, he didn't actually make them. But they wouldn't be there if it wasn't for him. It was back when I was working on the Excelsior. I was running for my life at the time. Something had gone wrong with the gravity, which was making it harder and harder to run, especially in my work shoes, which were in no sense designed for running. I remember opening the next door, jumping from foot to foot, whilst I waited for it to slide up. Then I pelted through and straight into a man carrying some pieces of electrical equipment. He fell to the floor and dropped it all. "Sorry," I said, though the more pertinent question was, what was he doing there and why wasn't he trying to get away? That's all right, he said, picking up his pieces. He had longish, wavy hair and friendly, relaxed eyes, and he wore a white shirt. I recognised him. I'd served him in the restaurant two nights before. He left a very good tip. "You shouldn't be here," I said. "No, you're right," he replied, picking up the last of the components and standing up straight. He wasn't that tall. I should be about 200 metres that way, patching all this gubbins into the retros to see if I can force a course correction. The ship made a deeply disquieting noise as its engine strained under unorthodox piloting. While I waited for the noise to die down, I took in what the man had just said. "Can you do that?" "Hypothetically, Seabean. Yes, I can." "How do you know my name?" He pointed at my uniform, specifically at the patch which read, "Hello, my name is Seabean." I felt like an idiot. "Come on, let's move," he said. "We don't have much time. In fact, I'm afraid we may not have enough." He jogged away in the other direction, gesturing for me to follow. "So who are you?" I asked. "The Doctor. Pleased to meet you again. I apologise for meddling with your super new cruise liner like this, but I'm concerned it's going to crash into, well, at best a moon or a planet, and at worst, the nearest star." "Wow, no, you go ahead then." I stopped and thought for a second. "Unless, of course, you're in league with the hijackers, in which case, I should probably stop you, surely." "If that were the case, then you should, but it isn't." I believed him, or at any rate, I thought I might as well. He wasn't trying to kill me, which the others certainly were. "What do they want?" I asked whilst we stopped, waiting for another door to slide open. "You know there's a VIP aboard?" "Of course, Ambassador Oatlin." We'd all been made very aware of the Ambassador's presence. Draconians are very particular about protocol, and we'd had a lengthy do's and don'ts class before he came aboard. It seems your hijackers were planning to engineer an accident for him, and for that matter, you and me and everyone else on the ship. "So why are they still here? Won't they die too?" "I'm sure they'd intended to be off this ship by now, but I've managed to delay them. Or some of them, at least. How many are still here?" "Not sure. They're holding hostages upstairs." "Demanding to know the location of the Ambassador, I expect. Well, he's long gone." "And we're stuck here on a crash course with the bad guys. Thanks, Ambassador." "Oh, I think we can do better than making sure they share our fate." "Can you really do it?" "I think all the engineering team are, dead. So you might be our only chance." "Yes," he said, "I may very well be. we came to a stop. The doctor put his pieces down on the floor, caught his breath, then added, although not your only chance. There are still escape pods, there, there, and there. He gestured at the wall. I assume that's why you were heading this way. I nodded, feeling slightly ashamed. As if I could have saved the ship like he was trying to do, if I'd only put the effort in. Very wise, he said, crouching down and sorting through the equipment he brought. I promise I'll come back to you and pick you up if I sort things out up here, but I shouldn't bank on it if I were you. I don't want to worry you too much. In fact, past form suggests I should be able to do it, but I occasionally worry that I will ride my luck a little too often. Will there be a pod left for you? I asked. If nobody else needs one, and if I don't leave it to the very last second. Isn't there anything I can do to help? I don't, he began. He stood and peered up at my hair, then plucked a hairpin from it. Thank you, he said, but now you really ought to go. The engines made that noise again, and suddenly I didn't need any extra encouragement. I hopped into the escape pod, activated it, and 15 seconds later, I was pulling away from the ship. Through the tiny window, I could still see the doctor working. He stopped to give me a wave, and I remember thinking how awful it would be if the 2 seconds he spent doing that were all that cost him his chance to save the ship. Pod asked me if it was okay to go into stasis. I said yes,
and got myself
comfortable for the journey.
With a start, I realised that the journey was already over. There was daylight at the window, the hatch was opening. For a second, I was worried that the atmosphere outside wouldn't be okay, but then I realised that the pod wouldn't have woken me up if it wasn't. It wouldn't even have landed here, so everything had to be fine. I took some deep breaths. We all got trained for stasis before we joined the ship, and I'd gone through it with the passengers countless times during the welcome drills. But the problem is that the experience is over before you get a chance to remember your training. The important thing isn't where you are, but when it is. For all I knew, I could have been floating for 3 million years. I realised this and hoped I hadn't. I checked the chronometer and it told me I'd been out for just over 5 days, which wasn't so bad. However, there was an irritating fault in the navigation system. That meant I had no idea where I was or what I should do now that I was here. I couldn't find maps of the place or anything, so that was useful. I found the emergency supplies bag and checked the contents, feeling like I should be in the passenger lounge enacting all this for an audience. I'd shown them the emergency basics so many times. I asked why it couldn't be pre-recorded to save the effort, but apparently people pay more attention when it's live, and it was oddly just as dull doing it for real. Food, water, clothes, blankets, tent, comm, flare, medical kit. Everything was here. So was the navigator, but that was of pretty limited use without a map to download, though it did have some other useful functions that made it worth bringing. I hauled the bag over my shoulder and clambered outside, finding myself in a forest. Evergreens. It wasn't too cold, and from the blue sky it looked like morning. One thing did stick out like a sore thumb. All the trees were identical. This world had been terraformed then, and if someone had gone to that much trouble and expense, it meant that there had to be humans here. I decided to head for the edge of the forest and get my bearings. I couldn't see anything from where I was. The escape pod also supplied a waterproof jacket and trousers that were considerably more practical than what I was wearing, so I got changed. The size adjustment on the boots was a bit basic, and I found that I was between 2 sizes. The company cut a few corners in those, I think, so I decided to have them too loose rather than too tight. I started walking. I woke up 2 days later, in a very small room, and as I tried to move, I remembered that my feet, legs, and pretty much the rest of my body were all suffering the after effects of spending so long walking through the forest with hardly a rest. I felt very warm and slightly dizzy. "Hey, lie down, you," said a voice to my side. I looked round and saw a young woman wearing the same standard issue clothes as me. She was blonde, slim, and sharp-featured, and, come to think of it, I recognised her. I had served her in the bar, and she was with the doctor in the restaurant. "Who are you?" I asked. "Lucy," she said. "You?" "Sabine. Can I have some water?" "Of course," said Lucy, and held a bottle out to me. I sipped from the straw and lay back down again. "How are you feeling?" Lucy asked. "My head's pounding," I said. "I'm hot." "Well, you're certainly not my type. All I know is that this thing says you're getting better," said Lucy, holding up the scanner from one of the standard issue medical kits. I tried and failed to read the screen. My head was aching. "Why?" I asked. "What happened?" "Hypothermia. I found you out there in the snow." The snow had caught me by surprise. Having just spent 2 days walking under clear skies, I thought this was fair. The clouds had arrived and the snow set in within a matter of minutes. And I had no time to find cover. Before long, I was up to my knees in it. I must have fallen or something. I still don't remember. "Thanks," I said, which seemed woefully inadequate. I thought I'd have reached the edge of the forest ages ago. It just goes on and on. "Yeah," said Lucy. "Makes that one out of Lord of the Rings look like a slightly overgrown back garden, doesn't it?" I had no idea what she was talking about, which I attributed to the delirium. "Where are we now?" "In my tent," she said. I propped myself up and looked around properly. "Oh, of course. I'm always showing people how to put these up, but I've hardly ever been inside one." "Yeah, I was at the safety session. I saw you." "Did you get the tent up all right?" "Yeah, I mean, they're not a massive challenge, are they? Just press some buttons and there it is." She tapped on the wall with her knuckle. "But how did you pitch it in this weather?" I didn't. It was still up from the night before. I overslept," she said, biting her bottom lip. "Could you turn the lights down a little?" "Oh, sure, sorry." She turned the dial next to the hatch and the tent darkened. "Thanks. Is it still snowing?" "No, it stopped not long after I got you inside. But I'm not sure how to get out. It's almost covering the whole tent. We've just got a little bit sticking out on top. I'm afraid to open the hatch in case we get a big drift in here." "Easy. You can adjust the heat retention of the outer skin. Turn it down to nothing. That'll let out the heat and the snow should melt away." Lucy blinked. "Yeah, that should work. Perhaps I should have thought of that if I paid attention in GCSE physics." She was still confusing me. She adjusted the heating controls and then pointed at them and turned to me. "Have I done that right?" I nodded. "It will take a little while. Have a look in about half an hour. I think you still need some rest anyway." "I'm feeling better, actually." I turned to lie on my side. "I think I remember you. I think I remember you. You were with that guy on the ship, weren't you?" "What? The doctor?" "Yes. I saw him again just before I got out. He helped me into an escape pod." Lucy bristled. "He does that whether you like it or not. I wanted to stay and help. He bundled me into one of them pods and had me ejected, thank you very much." "He'll have just been looking out for you." "I can look out for myself. I think he's a bit sexist sometimes, or speciesist. I'm going to have words with him next time I see him." "If he got off the ship." "He'll have got off. He's got more lives than all those cats in the crazy old cat lady's house at the end of my road combined, that one." A little while later, we emerged into a near-perfect circle where the snow had melted away. Lucy packed up the tent, whilst I established which way was which in the much-changed landscape. We didn't want to go deeper into the forest. She'd had the same idea as me, and her pod had the same fault with the maps. It took me a surprisingly long time to notice the flecks of colour under the snow on the nearest trees, and on every tree within view. "Lucy!"
"What?"
"Look, there's something on the trees." I couldn't see what they were under the snow, but they glinted red, yellow, purple, blue, silver, gold. Lucy marched over to the tree, declared it to be funny, then shook the snow off. "Should you do that?" I asked. "They might be, well, I don't know, anything. They might explode." She gave me an odd look. "Give over," she said, brushing more snow from a branch to reveal that hanging from it at regular intervals were gold and silver discs. She pulled one from the tree and it came away easily. "Is it metal?" I asked. "No, Dunno what it is. She handed it to me. I ran a finger over it. Feels like shrink wrap. There was an overlap at the edge and I pulled at it. The layer of plastic came away and underneath, chocolate, said Lucy. You're joking. Only one way to find out, said Lucy, took it from me and popped it in her mouth. Mmm, she said, and good thick chocolate. Not the rubbish you always used to get in these when I was a kid. I plucked another coin from the branch, unwrapped it and ate it. It was good. We each took a couple more. Then I noticed something. Lucy, whom? She asked through a mouthful of chocolate. Have you looked at the pictures in these? Lucy shook her head. Isn't this, you? I held out one of the coins and she scrutinised it. It is as well, she said. How? She quickly grabbed more of the coins and looked at each one. I'm on all of them. Not a bad likeness, really. But I think I've got a bit more up front, though. She swept the snow from more branches. She was on every coin we could find. We also uncovered several shiny cylinders of various colours. Lucy laughed. Crackers! Christmas crackers and alien trees on a distant planet. I ate another chocolate coin whilst I considered this. But who put all this here? And, why? Lucy shrugged. Dunno about the first part. Santa, maybe. But as for the second part, I'd guess it's because it's Christmas. I checked my chronometer. She was right. 5 days in stasis, plus 2 out here walking, made it the 24th of December, Earth time. It was early evening, where we were. But how, though? They weren't here before. I turned to Lucy. Are you sure I was only asleep for a few hours? I'm not one for making stuff up. Lucy pulled at one of the crackers, a bright red one, then pulled at it again. It didn't come away from the branch. Stuck, she said, and examined it more closely. Then she craned her neck forward for a better look. Now that I do not believe, she said, and gestured for me to look. The cracker was joined to the tree by a tiny stem, which faded from green at the tree end to red at the cracker end. It was growing out of the tree. How, said Lucy, is that possible? Just bioengineering, I said. Not really any different from making a tree grow bigger or greener apples or whatever. It's a bit different. Not that much. I've never seen one that did this before, but I've seen lots of experiments with making stuff grow in trees. Back home, they even had one that grew bacon. I looked around. They must have wired this in when they were terraformed. If it happens every year, they should put it out on the tour. Lucy searched her bag and found a knife. She cut the cracker stem and removed it from the tree. She pointed the cracker towards me. Come on then. What? Pull it. Lucy nodded. I had visions of this all being some elaborate trap. But Lucy's confidence drew me along, even though I had no reason to believe that she knew any better than me. I took the other end and we pulled. The snap was impressively heavy, resounding from the trees around us, but the fizz of coloured lights left something to be desired. Lucy seemed impressed, though. She was also gloating slightly because she won. She tipped the cracker upside down and let the prizes slide out. First, she put the hat on, and then she read out the joke. What do you call a rootin' playing a trumpet? I don't know. Rootin' tootin'. I gave it some thought. I don't get it. Mainly because I didn't know what a rutan was. I still don't. Neither do I. But I know who does. This is one of the doctor's jokes, such as it is. So he's a joke writer for Christmas crackers? No, no, Lucy paused. At least, not that I know of. But look at my picture on all the coins. I think he's trying to send me a message. What else was in that one? Lucy held up a scroll, only a little smaller than the cracker itself, and a whistle. She unfurled the scroll and we both looked at the collection of lines and symbols inside. It's a map, exclaimed Lucy. More than that, it was a map of where we were, comprising the forest and a settlement just outside it. There was an arrow pointing at the forest marked, You are here, and another one pointing at the settlement marked, We are being held hostage here. Help! Do you think that's where we are? I asked, pointing at the first arrow. Lucy looked at me. I'd have thought that's what it meant, yeah. No, I mean, can we trust it to be accurate? I reckon so. The doctor's put this here. He must be in trouble, Lucy sighed. Typical. But how would he know that you'd pick that cracker of all the ones you could have picked? Lucy looked around, then trudged through the snow towards one of the other trees. She plucked another cracker from a branch, then went to the next tree and took one from that, then grabbed five more before coming back to me. We pulled one of the crackers. This time I won and looked inside. I found a hat, which Lucy insisted I put on. The same joke again, another whistle and another map. We pulled more. More whistles, more maps. So what are the whistles for, I asked. There was a label on the side. Fairy summoner, they do your bidding. Impress your friends and family. Lucy put one to her lips and blew it. It made no noise. She looked at it. Did it work, or was it like one of those dog ones? No idea. You blow one. I did so. It tasted faintly of wood and rose water. Mine made no noise either. But then I heard something else, and so did Lucy. Movement coming from the tops of the trees. The snow was sliding away, and there was a sound like wings beating. There were small, slender, light-coloured creatures emerging from under the snow. They rose, then swooped down towards us, those delicate-looking wings beating rapidly. I ducked and covered my head. A few seconds later, nothing too alarming had happened. Lucy tapped my shoulder. It's all right, she said. I think. I looked up. Hovering in front of us was a row of 12 tiny fairies, each about 30 centimetres high. They had glowing skin, wide eyes and smiling mouths. They were sort of scary, though I quickly gathered that they were flesh constructs of some kind. Do they do our bidding? I asked. Dunno, said Lucy. I haven't bidden them yet. She blew on the whistle again. You lot, fly round in a circle, she said. The fairy stood to attention, then flew up and started to whiz around in neat, evenly spaced formation. Lucy looked over at me and raised her eyebrows. Then she blew the whistle again. That's nice, she said to the fairies, who stopped circling and looked down at her. How about helping us clear a path through all this snow? We want to go that way, she pointed. The fairies nodded in unison, then swooped down to the surface of the snow and, surprisingly, burst into flames one by one. They pushed a fast line through the snow, melting it away. More than that, the snow simply vaporized. They did this for about 200 metres before Lucy blew the whistle again. The fairies stopped, rose into the air and returned. There wasn't a mark on them. Even their little wispy clothes were intact. I don't remember that being traditional, I said. Do you? We weren't that far from the edge of the forest, and, with the fairies' help, it only took a couple of hours to walk out. Night had fallen. Right at the edge, in the valley, was a small colony town, which, if we'd navigated it properly, had to be the one marked on the map with the help sign. Unsurprisingly, given the local materials to hand, much of it was built of wood. It was totally deluged with snow. Lucy got a waterproof sheet out of her bag, placed it on an outcrop of ground overlooking the town, and lay down in it. What are you doing? I asked. Do you want them to see us? She replied. Who? The hostage takers. I can't see any hostage takers. Then get down before they see us. She blew her whistle and gestured for the fairies to get down onto the sheet as well. I followed suit. Wish we had some binoculars, Lucy said. I reached into my bag, brought out the navigator, and flipped the lens cap off the camera. I handed the navigator to Lucy. Stroke the control on the side to 200 metres in and out, I told her. Oh, said Lucy. Cheers. She took them from me and pointed it at the town. Has this got infrared? Infra what? So you can see in the dark. I reached across, brought up the menu and switched night vision on. Cheers, said Lucy again. This is an ace gadget, isn't it? I might keep mine. She fixed her gaze on the screen and zoomed in. I tried to see over her shoulder. Quiet, she said. Very, very quiet. A few paths had been dug out through the snow between the buildings, but there was no one about. One of the buildings, a large one, right at the centre of the settlement, had lights on. None of the others did. "We," said Lucy, "need a plan." I peered around the corner of the building we were hiding behind. The central building was a short distance away, and we could hear very, very muffled noises of movement and conversation coming from inside. "Don't look," scolded Lucy. "Why haven't they started yet?" I asked her. "Because I haven't given them the signal yet. Calm down, you." "I thought that was the signal." "Thought what was the signal?" "Just now. That was the signal for them to take up positions. I'm going to do the signal for them to start." "When?" "Now." "Oh, okay. If that's quite all right with you." "Yes, fine." Lucy blew her whistle again. The noise of the fairies lighting up was audible through the night air. I glanced at the building, ignoring Lucy telling me not to again, and saw one side of the wall catching fire. "Is it lit?" asked Lucy. I turned back to her and nodded. "Be ready to put it out again if it gets out of control." We'd found fire extinguishers in one of the outbuildings, but no weapons, irritatingly. Lucy didn't seem to think that was important. She liked her plan as it was. About a minute later, the door to the central building opened and two men, dressed in crew overalls from the Excelsior, rushed out, holding weapons. I recognised them right away as part of the group who had hijacked the ship. They made a surprise exclamation when they saw the fire and dashed back inside to fetch extinguishers. They returned and put the fire out, which saved us the trouble of doing it. "Now?" asked Lucy, and I told her yes. She blew the whistle once more, and the fairies swooped down from the roof and blazed in front of the two men's eyes. They cried out, temporarily blinded. Lucy and I rushed over and plunged the hyposyringes from our medical kits into their arms and gave them each a heavy dose of general anaesthetic before they even saw us coming. Even as they fell unconscious to the floor, we were already taking cover again. "I wasn't thinking," I said after a glance back. "We should have taken their guns." Lucy shrugged. "Nah. We'll be all right without." Five more people came out, again with guns. This time, Lucy blew down hard on her whistle and didn't stop until she'd run out of breath. I joined her. Within moments, the little town was swept by a storm of fairies trailing fire across the sky. The armed men had no idea what was happening, and you couldn't exactly blame them. The fairies didn't hurt anyone. That is, as long as the men didn't stupidly try to swat them away and burn their hands. And Lucy and I were able to easily dart between them without being seen. I tried to shut out the flurry of burning criss-crossing lights and focus on grabbing arms and plunging the hypo into them. I concentrated on the hiss of the hypo as it automatically sterilised itself. Everything stopped, and Lucy and I, amid seven unconscious bodies, she had the whistle to her lips. The fairies hung in the air around us, awaiting further instructions. Lucy strode over to the door, which was closed and locked. "How do we get inside?" I asked. Lucy gave two of the fairies instructions, then flew to the hinges and smouldered them free from the door. Lucy dodged back as the door fell outwards and landed heavily in the snow. Then she had to dodge gunfire as two more armed men raced forwards. "How many more?" Lucy moaned. Then she whistled and ordered the fairies to fly at the oncoming assault. They buzzed around the men's baffled faces, and Lucy simply stepped over them and said, "Hold out your arms, please." They did so, transfixed and pretty terrified by the fiery things hanging close enough to singe their facial hair, of which they had quite a bit. Lucy dosed them up, and they tumbled to the wooden floorboards. Lucy exhaled heavily. "Is that the lot?" I looked inside the door. A man was approaching along the corridor, his hands behind his back. He strolled outside and surveyed our handiwork, then looked at me. "Hello again," said the doctor. "Glad to see you made it." "Glad to see you made it too," I said. "Oi!" said Lucy. The doctor turned to face her. "Good work, Lucy." He glanced down at the hijackers. "They're not dead, are they?" "Course not," said Lucy. "Just checking, just checking." "I've got something I'd like to just check," said Lucy. Did I give you permission to shove me in an escape pod and chuck me off the cruiser? Because I don't remember that at all. The doctor winced. Please, Lucy, could we not do this here? And could one of you untie my hands? There was a lot of gratitude. Lucy and I were given the freedom of the town, which is a pretty sizable city these days. After the hijackers were restrained and the other escapees from the ship, including the ambassador, had been contacted, I asked the doctor about the Excelsior. Saved, he said. It's in orbit right now. It went extremely well, actually, all up to the point where the hijackers captured me. So how did you all end up here? They followed the escape pods, hoping they'd find their target and end up here. Ordered the inhabitants to use the weather controls to turn up the snow, basically hoping the survivors would get caught in it and die. But their technical lads told me about the Christmas bloom programmed into the trees, which, as luck would have it, were due to come out within a day. As we'd been given access to the environmental controls, reprogramming the trees and changing the contents of the crackers, giving the fairies a few little extra abilities, was easy. I knew Lucy would pick it up. Sharp as a tack, me, said Lucy dryly, walking over to us. Doctor, have you seen this? She was cradling one of the fairies. It looked weak. Ill, in fact. Said the doctor. I was afraid of this. What? I said. Living beings designed for decorative purposes. They're not designed to exist for longer than a few days. Oh, no, said Lucy. I shrugged. That's pretty normal. The doctor glowered at me. It shouldn't be. These are living creatures. Creating them doesn't give anyone the right to throw them away when you don't need them anymore. But they're not intelligent. How do you know? Snapped Lucy. And they helped us too. I must admit, I haven't exactly helped either, said the doctor. My modifications to them have only hastened the end, I expect. They've literally burned brightly, but all the more briefly. I suddenly felt very, very bad. Well, isn't there anything you can do? The doctor smiled. I never said there wasn't. The doctor worked all through Christmas Day. He synthesised the smart drug that he said would fix the fairies, but he wouldn't tell anyone the exact details, probably because he was afraid they'd undo it. He told the townspeople in no uncertain terms that he didn't approve and that he wouldn't tolerate another batch of fairies being grown for the trees next year. He and Lucy left after that. The fairies didn't die. If you go there today, you can see them still there, flying through the forest. He made them all live. Nobody knows how long for. Maybe they'll outlive us all. Maybe they'll be there forever. You should go and see them someday, though. There's something really special. Just don't get too close to them. That's all.
Happy Christmas, Doctor. And happy Christmas to everyone else, too.
You're listening to Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that's had this place redecorated recently. We're continuing our exploration of those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord as played by Paul McGann. I'm Rebecca Chapman.
And I'm Kenny Smith, and you join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audios, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, magazines, and more.
Indeed. We have exhausted the Eighth Doctor and Sam Jones mine of stories for now, so we have got into the Christmas spirit by bringing you this short trip reading.
We have. You've just heard Decorative Purposes in my dulcet tones and my appalling Lancashire accent. So, yeah, that's how good it was, Becca. So let's find out a wee bit more about the story. Becca, would you do the honours, please?
I don't know if I want to after hearing that Lancashire accent. That was so bad.
Yeah. Listeners overseas, Lancashire accent sound exactly like that. And Becca's just jealous because she can't do one as good as that. Honest.
Definitely. Yes. Okay. I don't need my reading voice for this, do I?
You can do your reading voice if you like. It is a tradition, after all.
It is indeed. Decorative Purposes was the 21st short story in the Short Trips anthology, Short Trips, The Ghosts of Christmas, published on the 5th of December, 2007. It was written by Eddie Robson and featured the Eighth Doctor and Lucy Miller.
Lucy Miller! Lucy Bleeding Miller! Get in! I love Christmas. And I love the Eighth Doctor and Lucy. So this one was always going to be a winning combination for me. Love this story. We've got elements of... I mean, this, as you said, this story came out in 2007. This one came out in 2007, so it's, 4 years ahead of The Doctor, The Widow and the Wardrobe, which has gotten a lot of similar elements with trees which grow Christmas decorations and things like that, and an alien world where snows appeared. And there's thematic similarities, although it's obviously not completely the same story. Did you enjoy The Doctor, The Widow and the Wardrobe and all those scenes in the forest with the trees growing bulbs? Or bulbs? They're baubles.
I was a huge fan of the Chronicles of Narnia growing up. And I mean huge.
Yeah.
So the Widow, the Witch, the Widow, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Yes.
Lion.
Ah, the Lion, the Witch. No. The Doctor Who one.
Oh, the Doctor, the Widow and the Wardrobe. Yes, that's it.
Right,
yeah.
Yes, that one.
We're both getting confused.
Oh, yeah, it was fantastic. I loved it so much. It gave me all of the Narnia vibes. I loved the trees, the baubles. Everything and the ending with the plane. And
yes, and Alexander Armstrong comes back, and it wasn't a pointless story in the end.
I love the pun. It was fantastic.
There's the first.
But I know your puns are usually really bad, Kenny.
I know. I try.
But yeah, it made me really happy, and I'm actually in my rewatch of New Who. I have just started Matt Smith. So I am very excited to get to this episode again.
Yep. Oh, you've not got long to go. Excellent. But will you be able to reach it before Christmas Day? Who knows? Oh, no, you won't, because you'll have to get through A Christmas Carol first. So you'll hopefully reach that. But that would be a good bit of festive viewing. But no, coming back to this one, I just love The Doctor and Lucy. Obviously, they had a few Christmas stories in audio. Death in Blackpool, maybe not the happiest Christmas story going, but we did later get Relative Dimensions, which we covered last year with Mark Platt, and it was great. I enjoyed that one. But yeah, this one is a nice, happy Christmassy story. It's not overly Christmassy, but it definitely has all the elements they would expect with fairies and everything else. So yeah, so I've just got really, having listened to this, got one request. I really want Lucy Miller in a Miss Santa outfit under the Christmas tree. And I want her in my stockings. No. Let's...
Yeah, while Kenny's mind is elsewhere, I think we need to redirect this conversation and have a chat with Eddie Robson, who wrote this fun tale.
Hello, I'm Eddie Robson, and I am the writer of Decorative Purposes.
Eddie, welcome back to Pieces of Eight. It's been far too long.
Oh, yeah, no, thanks for having me back on.
We're in the Christmas spirit at the moment, Eddie, as we're bringing your short trip from many, many moons ago back to life as we turn our eyes back to, or is it years, back to The Ghosts of Christmas, which a fabulous wee short trip. And what do you remember about the commission for it and how it all came about?
Do you know what? I don't remember that much about this. I think in the end, about half of my short trips for Big Finish ended up being Christmas stories. But I don't know. It was, there was definitely... I was just having a look back at the just before we came on. I just had a look back at the pitch. I dug up my original pitch, which is from 2007, and I actually don't really remember much about what the brief was. I think it was just a case of, from my perspective, of like, well, what have I not done before, and what have I not seen done? And I just came up with the whole Christmas decorations idea, and. For this one, I think they might have been quite keen on doing first-person narratives for this, and kind of sort of the sense of like the Doctor and all his companions kind of coming into people's lives in a slightly odd way and sort of focusing on being from their perspective. But apart from that, I don't really remember much about what the brief was, no.
Oh, because I think it's a lovely wee lively tale, and I think that you can just hear Sheridan's voice singing through as Lucy and Paul as the Doctor. Mm. And I suppose by this point you had a fair bit of Lucy Miller experience under your belt.
Yeah, actually, funnily enough, though, looking back at the date, it was 2007. In fact, I can see here my file for the synopsis is dated 24th of May 2007. So that was it was after the season had gone out, but before it had they'd finished putting them all out on CD. But I guess we would have done it we recorded them the previous summer, those plays, so it had been a little while. But yeah, I think the thing that I was most keen on was that because we'd at Big Finish creative companions were completely fair game for the short trips, and I was quite keen. Was this actually her first prose appearance?
I believe it is, just having had a quick look through. I think I'm pretty sure that it
would
is.
That would make sense, actually, yeah. But I think I was quite keen to do that, actually. I think having, I'd really enjoyed writing her on that season. So one of the first things I thought was, I think they asked me to pitch a McGann play, a McGann story, I think. And I don't know when they asked for Lucy, but if they didn't, I would have been very keen to do it and to make her first appearance in prose.
I'd imagine by this point, of course, you'd have heard Sheridan having played her. So you knew exactly the voice that you were writing for, unlike when
definitely.
You were doing the scripts before.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that was another reason why I was quite keen to have her in it, because I'd been there for a fair chunk of the recordings, so I'd heard her performance there and I'd heard all the plays. I don't know how far we wouldn't have recorded the next season yet, but it's possible that I was already writing or had written Grand Theft Cosmos by then. Mm. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure, but I think there's a fair chance that I'd already done it by then. Oh, in fact, I can tell you, I've got a scene breakdown for Grand Theft Cosmos in my files here, which is dated 27th of May, so I was writing these literally at the same time.
I love that kind of detail. Thank you, Eddie. We're not worthy. We are not worthy.
I keep everything.
Absolutely the way you should do it. And I always keep mine backed up in my, as I open my drawer here, I've got my external drive where everything's backed up. The one that I'm holding up has everything Big Finish has ever released, including Tomorrow People, Sapphire and Steel, everything. And Big Finish Companions are on there, and lots of stuff.
So how big is that? What storage do you need for that?
That's a 2 terabyte.
Yeah.
I need to get a new one, because I really should back up the backup, because I get paranoid. But
I do. I'd like, if the way I often find myself, I'll when I copy something over, I always get a bit paranoid about copying over the previous version of things like, what if that folder had something in it that isn't in the other one because I've moved things around? So I end up making a new folder and just like say, okay, this is a backup, and then there's like I relabel the other one backup. Yeah.
This is good. Pieces of me giving some advice there on how to back your files up and make sure you stay safe, because my God, you don't want to lose your hard drive, having thought I nearly had a few weeks ago, but there we go. Christmas. There's something very appropriate about Lucy at Christmas. It just seems to work. The fact that she's such a happy character, and here she is on a world of trees where we've got crackers growing out of them and things like that. It absolutely works.
Yeah. It's sort of, I think that's true, actually. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but it sort of suits her personality. And I think that also influenced the choice of characters in it. My viewpoint character, just someone who works in, essentially it's like hospitality, really. I thought that'd be someone who she could find relatable, even if it's in different time, a different place.
Absolutely worked for me. I think being a sort of fellow sort of working class kind of person, but in space, and
exactly.
They've got a nice wee chemistry, and they can empathize with one another and get each other.
But it's definitely, I think that's true. It's definitely, Lucy is a good character for this, because she's definitely someone who would just find that enjoyable, really. Like, she wouldn't be, would never have thought of Lucy as someone who'd be cynical about Christmas. I think she's definitely someone who would enjoy all the trappings of it.
Especially with the alcohol, but
yeah,
we don't quite get there. Now, having read this one back, it really reminded me in places of The Doctor, The Widow and the Wardrobe, with the forest and the magical trees.
Yes, that's the fact. That was one where I'm sure this is one of those cases of spontaneous spontaneous parallel development of ideas that it just sort of comes up eventually. But yeah, it was when I saw the episode, I was like, oh yeah, that whole thing of being on an alien planet and spontaneous Christmas decorations growing was. That did, like, oh yeah, that I did something rather like that before. Yeah,
I think that's the wonder of it, though. It's writers having these similar ideas, obviously executed in different ways. But I love the whole rationale for it all being a terraformed world and getting into the spirit of Christmas. It's just perfect.
I don't know. I don't know where that idea came from, but it was just once it kind of struck me, it was it just sort of played out quite nicely. I think I started with the idea of doing something about Christmas decorations. I think that was my first thought, was like, you try, sort of try and find the Christmas angle on something, and I think I just it just went from there.
Love it. How do you look back on it, having had a wee look over it again?
I don't know. It's sort of it's interesting. It's quite sort of early in me doing prose. I've sort of done a lot more since then, and some of it does sort of leap out. But I don't know. I think I haven't gone through the whole thing. I just kind of give it a quick skim to remind myself of what it was actually about and what happened. But yeah, it was. I think it's got a nice enough feel to it. I think it works.
It does. I think it was very. I could hear the snow crunching and everything like that, and just almost like you could visualize the flakes falling from the trees just when a little breeze goes through it. So it worked for me. So thank you for bringing us a bit of Christmas joy.
Yeah, well, you're very welcome.
But before we go, let's have a quick chat about what you've been doing since we last spoke, as you had a book out quite recently.
Yeah, I did. Over the summer, I had a new sci-fi novel out from Tor.com called Drunk on All Your Strange New Words, which is about someone who works as a interpreter for an alien ambassador in the not too distant future in Manhattan. She's from Halifax, and only a small number of people actually, because the aliens could communicate telepathically, only a small amount of humans are actually capable of doing this. They have the right kind of brain. So when people are found, then they are kind of whisked away and trained up. And so she feels quite sort of ill at ease, having come from this sort of Halifax council estate, and suddenly she's working for the cultural attaché in Manhattan. But she's sort of, she's struggling a bit with the job, but she's kind of soldiering on, and then suddenly her boss is murdered. So, she's the most obvious suspect because she's always with him, and yet she doesn't know how this might have happened. Oh, the title comes from the fact that when humans kind of process the alien language, it creates a chemical imbalance in the brain that is like being drunk. So she's sort of on top of having to deal with all the unfamiliarity and the pressures of the job. You have to sort of do it while half-cut all the time as well.
Fantastic. So that's Drunk on All Your Strange New Words. And where was that available from again?
Well, it's published by Tor.com. It's pretty easy to get hold of in the UK. I've seen it in Waterstones, and it's obviously on Amazon and Blackwells and all the usual websites. But listeners in America should be able to get hold of it pretty easily too.
Fantastic. Great stuff. I will be, as we said earlier, I'll be looking for something new to read over the Christmas holidays. So that's me sorted.
Oh, thank you.
But thanks again for your time, Eddie, and have a Merry Christmas.
Yeah, you too.
Right, that's me. 3, 2, 1, I'm back in the room. Thanks to Eddie for his time for our wee chat there, and also giving us the permission to use the story to make the episode possible.
Indeed, thank you so much. We are carrying on in the festive spirit tomorrow as we look at the making of another big Finnish Christmas story, Better Watch Out and Fairy Tale of Salzburg.
It's like Christmas has come early, but it hasn't. Because it's only the 23rd, so keep waiting, guys and girls and everything else. We're nearly there. So until then, I've been Kenny Smith.
And I've been Rebecca Chapman.
Sounded distant. You were getting distracted by the Christmas tree, weren't you?
I was. I got distracted by the Christmas tree, and then I got distracted by guys, girls, and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but see, everybody's included that way.
That is true. That is true. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, right. We'll be back tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Indeed, we will be. Bye.